Welcome back to Schneps Connects. Today I'm joined by Sherry Tucker. She's the CEO of Well Life Network. Well Life offers comprehensive programs focused on mental health, developmental disabilities, addiction recovery, and family services, all dedicated to promoting independence, resilience, and overall well-being. As a strategic financial leader, Sherry has a proven track record of driving growth and efficiency across various industries, from nonprofit health services to construction management. She is known for her ability to navigate complex financial landscapes and build ethical, transparent relationships while achieving impactful results. Today, we're going to talk about Well Life Network's work and its missions, of course. And Sherry, you know, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation.
So I touched on it a little bit, but why don't you share a little bit more about Well Life Network's mission?
Well, at Well Life Network, our mission is to foster an environment where individuals, families, and team members have the tools and support they need to thrive and live a well life. We're concerned for all those different groups, the individuals we serve, our team members, as well as the families that support people that we have in the different programs that we provide. So everybody deserves to have an opportunity to meet their dreams and goals. And that's what we try to do, is help them achieve that.
That's terrific. What geographic area do you offer services through?
So we have services in 4 of the boroughs. We don't currently have services in Staten Island. We used to, but we've pulled out of there for the moment. We may enter that arena again at some point in the future, but we also have services across Long Island in both Suffolk and Nassau County.
Well, that's great. So we have very overlapping geographic areas. That's a big part, yes, of where our media is, for sure. And, you know, mental health is a huge issue. I think most New Yorkers, you know, can see it on the streets of New York City. And I think having accessibility to care is so important. So what are you doing to address that?
At our organization, we have a number of programs that range in all different types of supports for individuals that have mental health challenges or any of the other vulnerabilities that you mentioned earlier. But for the mental health challenges that we're facing today, you know, let's face it, everybody is feeling the anxiety and the intensity of the world, as it seems it has ratcheted up after the pandemic, even to higher levels. And here in this part of the country, I'm from Indiana and Florida. This is like not quite my home stomping ground, but there's a different level of intensity here. I can tell you that from the other areas of the country, that makes it even more important to have all the supports that's necessary for people to achieve that stability in mental health. And so what we do at Well Life is we feel the cornerstone is safe, nurturing housing options for individuals. We have a lot of different housing opportunities for people that have mental health challenges, as well as those that just have, you know, economic challenges or other types of situations of homelessness and that type of thing. And in those arenas, then we wrap them with support services that provides them opportunity to find the right elements that they need for them to be able to achieve their goals and objectives. So that could be from a high level of intensity. If they have a situation where they don't feel comfortable going into a clinic setting, we will go to them. We have a lot of community outreach teams. We do have clinics available for people to come to receive services as well for substance use disorder, as well as mental health challenges. And then we also do something called care coordination, where we just work with people to help them find the best alternatives to meet their needs. And so we connect them with the right resources for them to address any mental health challenges they may be facing.
Are a lot of those connections made through hospitals or people reaching out to you? Or do you have like outreach at homeless shelters? Or how does that go about?
Yeah, all of the above. We really have a pretty strong network of referral sources, mainly because we are funded through the state of New York, the city of New York, Suffolk County, Nassau County, and many other levels. We do have some federal funding as well. Many times they have their own referral networks that they, you know, will send us individuals that they want us to interview and consider for our programs. There are some programs that we have where people from any walk of life can come in and apply or ask for services, but then there's others that are very prescriptive in terms of they have to come through specific referral sources in order to be eligible for the program. Many of our housing opportunities are of that nature, but we do have part of our housing continuum of care called mixed use affordable housing. And that's where we have a lot of growth that we provide people. And with that, there are opportunities for people to come in through lottery systems that the city sets up or the county set up, and then referrals from the funding agencies as well.
So is that housing something that's part of like a rehabilitation, or is that housing something that's permanent? And I'd be curious to hear what kind of housing it is.
We have all of the above. So we try to cover the entire spectrum. We have from the highest need, which would be what we call our congregate care. These are individuals that really need 24/7 support, which most of our housing does have 24/7 support, but this is a higher level of intensity. We provide their medications. We help them to get to their appointments, make sure they have the right connections in place. We cook their food. We, you know, help them in all aspects of life, help them with their daily living skills, make sure that they're taking care of themselves, their personal hygiene, that type of thing. And then we have the most independent living, which is called our supported housing. And that living is permanent housing. Most of the others are transitional, where we're trying to help them progress to get to the independent living solution for them. Some people can get there. Some people just don't have that capability. So they stop somewhere in our system and they stay in one of the other alternative housing options we have. But in the independent living, typically what the scenario will be is that someone in that setting, it'll be just like any other apartment building or apartment space that somebody lives in. They may have roommates, it may be a single unit, but they will be visited typically once a month by a case manager who checks in with them, make sure that they have all their medications in order, that they're going to their sessions, if they're in some kind of counseling, or if they're trying to get a job, help them with applications. You know, they just really check in with them and help them, again, to look at their life goals and try to help them make sure they have all the elements in place they need to achieve them.
Do you have any group homes by any chance, or is it mostly apartment living?
We do. We have many group homes, and that's in both the mental health and our developmentally disabled population. Mm. But the majority of the group homes would be in our IDD population, where those are sprinkled throughout Brooklyn and Queens, and they're some of my favorite places to visit, because when we have those individuals come join us, they become part of our family. Many times they're in a situation where they no longer have family members who are able to care for them, or they just need a higher level of care than what's available in their home. So they become part of our family, and we join in the raising or the continuing living of that person until they pass on. So they're with us from the time they come in until the time they pass.
What's the supply and demand like? Is there enough housing for the number of people out there?
There are not. The really sad statistic that was so alarming to me is 2 years ago, we opened a mixed-use housing apartment complex in Queens on Cypress Avenue. And it's a very beautiful building. We're very proud of it. We love to show it off if anybody ever wants to come see it and take a tour. But for that, there were a portion of those are what we call supported units. And those are the ones that we get referred to us through the different agencies. This particular building was funded by New York City and through their 1515 initiative. And those individuals came to us from the shelter system in order to give them permanent housing from that system. The other units are for those that are in the community that meet the income standards set by the IRS for tax credit funded buildings. And for 26 units that we had available, there were 26,000 applications. It just was mind-boggling to me that it's gotten to that point that there's so much demand and there's just not nearly enough available units. So we are very excited. The fact that we just had our closing on two new properties, have broke ground and we're getting in the process of building two new buildings, one in the Bronx. It will be 136 unit building, and then one on the island, which is a very big challenge to get housing in on the island, is in Medford, and it will be 67 units.
That's great.
So yeah, those will be done in about 18 months, and we'll be super excited to try to get some more people into these beautiful places to live.
You know, I know a big issue with mental illness is, you know, those that don't want to go in for rehabilitation or services. Mm. What do you find can be, you know, a solution in that case?
It really takes the personal relationship of our case managers. And I have to tell you, Josh, that the unsung heroes in this story are all the individuals that work for us, our staff, mm-hmm. our team. They work so hard. They dedicate their lives. And it really, truly is, you know, a dedication. We have so much longevity in our staff. Some have, this is the only job they've ever had, you know, from when they entered the job market, they're with us 30, 40 years. It's amazing to me, but they develop these relationships with the individuals that we serve that live with us, and they build a level of trust and help them to understand if you want to achieve some of the things you're looking to achieve, you're going to have to trust me and follow, you know, some of these pieces of advice that I'm giving you in terms of trying to get the right kinds of help or medication or, you know, those types of things in order for them to succeed. But there's always going to be those who are resistive, and it is sometimes a very difficult challenge to get everybody, you know, on the right track.
Are those rules different in different states, do you know?
I think there's some variation, but for the most part, there's a lot of similarity. It is different funding streams and different approaches, and obviously the population levels affects that a lot. Like what we do down here in downstate New York is so different than what happens in upstate, but it's the same goal to get people stable, safe, secure, and with the right level of supports in order for them to live a fulfilling life.
What about preventative care? I'm sure a lot of people want to get support before it comes to a critical point. What is WellLife doing in terms of that?
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a lot of opportunity to train, put education out to the community at large to try to help people understand the different challenges they may be feeling in life. If they're starting to feel levels of anxiety or concern, or they see habits forming that are not productive, how they can reimagine and go forward in a different way, or how they can plug into different resources to help them get back on the right path. We also, the individuals that we serve, we also try to keep them on a track of getting all that preventative care. It's so important for people to have those, you know, annual checkups and make sure they're keeping their blood pressure and all their different levels in their blood, cholesterol and things of that nature in order, because if their body gets out of whack, then they're going to have, you know, so many more challenges to deal with. And our ultimate goal is to keep everybody healthy, out of the hospitals, and on a path for wellness. We try to promote a lot of social activities, but we have found in our mental health housing that at times, and especially since the pandemic, people were isolating more and getting more anxiety from that type of thing and feeling disconnected with the world, and then they'd start to decompensate. So we put in recreational programs. We kind of did that as an internal initiative, and we're working with the state now to try to build that into more programmatic funding sources. But what we'll do is we have a team that will set up different activities, like going into the city to see a show, or, you know, doing some crafting projects, or going to the beach, or going to an amusement park, and they'll take groups with them, develop the opportunity for people to socialize and get out into the community. Many times people have never been to one of those types of things. They've never been able to go to Broadway or go to an amusement park. And so they're just thrilled in order, you know, to experience these types of things. And it really just contributes to their well-being and keeping them on a path to good health.
You talked about that massive disparity between, you know, supply and demand. What are some of the really key challenges faced by nonprofits such as yours?
Well, there's a lot of them, but some of the bigger ones, especially in the housing arena, is trying to get through all the different required elements to get a property ready to be considered for funding. So we just went to, just this week, myself and associate went to a community board meeting in Brooklyn because there's a piece of property there that we'd really like to develop. And we have to get a letter of support from the community board. We never want to build a building anywhere that we're not wanted. We've had situations where it's almost been like those pitchfork meetings where you're kind of run out of town feeling, which is really sad to see happen. But, you know, we don't force an issue because the last thing we want to do is have individuals who are trying to get a good footing be traumatized by a community that doesn't welcome them. But in any event, we try to go into these communities and talk with individuals about getting these letters of support, and there's still a stigma about mental health. And so when we mention people with mental health challenges, people get very nervous. But the thing I try to assure them of is this is prevalent. This is something that's in society. And to have a building where you have individuals there who are being cared for and supported is much better than having a building with no one there to help care for and support people. We are the eyes and ears of making sure everybody's staying on the right path, being productive and achieving their goals. So we, you know, try to let them know that that stigma has no place in this world today, that we need to accept people where they are and help them to get on the path to where they need to be. And that's what we as an organization does. So that challenge of trying to get everybody to embrace our mission and understand what we're trying to do, as well as just getting all the elements in place to make it work financially. Many times the funding requires us to have units that are smaller than the communities would like. They'd like, you know, units with multiple bedrooms and bathrooms so they can have large families, but it just doesn't work in the financial equations for us to do that. My background is accounting, so I'm always looking at the numbers to try to make sure these things are going to work. Being a nonprofit, we're not in it for a profit, but we're in it to be financially viable. So we always have to make sure we're at a break even and trying to achieve that. And that leads to another challenge that we have as a nonprofit is just always trying to manage the rates that are given by the government. Yeah. You know, they're doing their best to give us the money that we need, but it's never quite enough, especially in the pay structures for our staff. We have these dedicated people that I talked about before that are the heroes of this story. They should be paid a lot more money for the work that they do. They are, you know, caring for people in a way that many people would not even consider doing. And we're not paying people much more than what you could pay at a fast food restaurant. So, you know, when people have a choice between those two options, they really have to have a heart for service.
Yeah, it's a hard job.
So those are probably the two most prevalent. And because of the wage structure, it makes us have a lot of workforce shortage challenges. We've been overcoming that slowly. We'll try to add a lot of extra bonus type things for our staff. We do something called Funterventions. This was an idea I got from a podcast I listened to about a year ago. And it's really trying to weave in things where the staff can become more familiar with each other, feel they have a common sense of belonging to the organization, and have some fun and, you know, try to eliminate some of the burnout that comes from the intense emotional levels that they have to give in these positions. So we add in these fun things. We try to, you know, do different activities for people. So we meet everybody in different areas of interest. And so we work really hard to make sure our workforce is well cared for, because we know we have to have a healthy workforce in order to have good outcomes on the care that we give individuals.
Yeah, no, that's terrific. You know, you touched on your need of state government funding and how you work with the community, but can you elaborate a little bit on how you collaborate in other ways with government and community partners?
Yes, we really value our partnerships with all of the oversight agencies. We work heavily with Office of Mental Health, the Office of People with Developmental Disabilities, and the Office of Alcoholism and Abuse. And those entities all are the ones that really give us the rules that we have to play by. But they also are very open to hearing our needs and working with us and collaborating with us. So if we see something like the recreational program I spoke about before, we'll take that to them and talk to them about, hey, we have this idea. Would you be willing to maybe consider this in some of your funding streams? We will work with them on when they put out requests for proposals on new programs. We'll get with them and, you know, work with them. We were just awarded a new one for some additional housing in the Bronx and Upper Manhattan. And so we had a meeting today with them collaborating on how we were going to make that come to life, what the important elements are, where we want to focus our attention on eliminating some of the challenges they might be facing. And so there's a real good synergy that comes from those funding agencies. They're very interested in hearing what we have to say. And of course, we always want to be in line with what they're trying to achieve.
You know, those challenges with workers, it must be so difficult because it really is a difficult job. I mean, it is, you know, really holding the hands of people that need that support 24/7. How are you going about fostering that talent? You talked a little bit about, you know, those events, but what other initiatives are you putting in place to be able to support, you know, bringing in people and having them grow careers?
So we work really hard on trying to make career pathways for individuals that work for us. And through that, the state has actually been starting to put out a lot of initiatives where they're offering scholarship opportunities. But what that means is we administer that and push it out to the staff to help encourage them to, you know, take some courses so that they can keep progressing in their career and achieve additional opportunities in what they can do. We also have tuition reimbursement internally that we fund ourselves through the company, as well as we encourage people to go just, you know, seek out training. We have a very big learning management system that has a lot of courses on it that allows them to get their continuing education credits. We fund that, we pay for that. So we're always very interested in trying to promote from within. And we have so many staff that started out at our entry level positions that are now in our management level positions. And we're very proud of that.
Good to hear. What would you say is the future? What are you thinking is next for the Well Life Network?
Well, there's a lot, you know, as I mentioned, the housing that we're trying to continue to develop, that's always first and foremost in our minds because we think that is the cornerstone for healthy living. But we also are looking deeply into technology. We know that there's a lot of information that can be gained from data. Yeah. So we're working on trying to get our data, you know, in a more organized fashion so that we can make some good decisions based on what we're seeing from the trends that are occurring. We have instituted a new technology in the last couple of years that allows our community outreach teams to have in the palm of their hand all the important elements and information they need when they go knock on a door. We want them to have safety. We want them to have knowledge about the person they're going to see. And we want them to have connection with the team back in the main office that they know where they are. So we're using a technology that we've partnered with an organization to develop that's been very effective. And it gives the staff, you know, if they get in an uncomfortable situation, there's a little SOS button that they can press very discreetly. Because sometimes if somebody's getting agitated and they see you trying to call 911 or call somebody for support, it makes them more agitated. So they can be very discreet and reach out for help. And that's been a big relief for me. We've had some unfortunate times where people have had, you know, a situation where they've been injured because of a situation that spiraled out of control. And they asked me as CEO, what are you going to do to protect us? So when this came along, I was very relieved that we were able to give them a tool that could help them in that scenario, as well as give them ability to know, you know, if somebody's got a triggering situation, like a death of a loved one happened this time last year or something of that nature, they can look at it on their phone right before they knock on the door so they can talk to them about it, anticipate that there may be some challenges that they're facing that they can help them through and try to, you know, work with them more effectively and efficiently. So technology, there's a lot with AI that's starting to bubble to the surface in terms of how we can make things more efficient and improve the ability for our staff to be effective in the work that they're doing.
Well, Sherry, thank you so much for sharing about Well Life Network. I have to say, I think mental health is one of the biggest issues in the city, and hopefully the state will continue to find more funds to be able to support you and other organizations like yours. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed our conversation.
It was a pleasure. If you'd like to listen to more of our podcasts and other episodes of Schneps Connects, visit podcast.schnepsmedia.com, and you can stream the podcast on all major podcast platforms.